Greetings once again to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends, allies, and students scattered across the planet, and anyone else who cares to listen. This is your navigator, John Lash, recording on the 17th of February, 2013. This would be Nav Briefing 49, and the title is When Patriarchy Goes Down. Before I begin, I'd like to make a couple of references and a small correction to the previous briefing. In the recording, I said that it was Nav Briefing 47, but it was, in fact, 48. That was the briefing on the subject of the ultimate secret of the Gaian Dakinis. Also, I mentioned that Jan was 15 when we met in New York City in 1967. But actually, she was 14. I met her a month before her 15th birthday. And it was a remarkable meeting by all accounts. I can assure you of that. Jan at that time did not introduce herself as the daughter and only child of Jack Kerouac. You may know that Jack Kerouac is an American literary icon, sometimes known as the King of the Beats, and one of the leading figures in the literature of the Beat Generation that emerged in the United States following World War II. In fact, Jack Kerouac was writing on the road during the time in 51, 52, when Jan was born in 52. And that very cold, bitter January and February in New York City was the setting for this meeting. Some of you may be curious about Jan, and I just want to say that you can read her books if you like. She wrote two books. One is called Baby Driver, in which she describes some of our moments together, including the moment in Jalapa, Mexico, when she gave birth to a stillborn child. It was not my child, but that was an experience that we shared together, which opens Baby Driver. And then her second book, Train Song, also contains some incidents in our lives and is dedicated to me. So if you want to read Jan, who is a delightful writer, you can probably find those books, used books, on the internet because they're out of print now. Just want to say that in my first conversations with this 14-year-old girl who had already taken LSD, I think she said 12 times, I had only taken it twice, I think, at that point. We later took it together and wrote extensively about it in the novel that we wrote in Jalapa. In my first conversation with Jan, she told me two things. I mean, this is a 14-year-old girl living in the slums of the Lower East Side, okay, without a father, with a mother on welfare. She tells me two things that proved to be enormously significant in my later writing, in my investigations into shamanism. First thing that she told me was that she had seen the molecular structure of DNA when she was high on acid. The second thing that she told me was that she described an experience, an acid trip she had. That's the quaint old jargon, you know, an acid trip. She described in detail an experience that she had walking around the Lower East Side in the pitch of night by herself, 2, 3, 4 in the morning, stoned on LSD. And she underwent an experience in which the entire city of New York turned into a necropolis. Jan knew words like this. She used the word necropolis. She also said that she felt that she was being followed by Anubis, the jackal god of the necropolis, and that she would sort of turn her head slightly, and out of the corner of her eye, she would see Anubis perched on a street corner or perched on a bench in Tompkins Square Park. And there she is, this stunning 14 or 13-year-old girl with jet black hair down to her bottom, walking around the streets of New York City in a trance. Jem was fascinated with Egyptian lore and the whole mystique of ancient Egypt. And one of the first things that we talked about was Egyptian mythology. And I had these two books, The Gods of the Egyptians by Wallace Budge, and we used to pore over these books together and look at the images of the various animal-headed totemic deities. So anyway, to get to the real core of the second subject that Jan discussed with me, she described in vivid detail how the psychedelic trance put her in a state where she detected the chirality of the world. The chirality being the handedness, C-H-I-R-A-L-I-T-Y, the handedness of things. So when you look at the world, when you look at your own body, you see that it is designed to have a right and a left hand. The field of vision has a right and a left component. Many processes in nature have these right and left aspects. This is called chirality. And also, in the molecular world and in the invisible world, many of the processes to be detected have the nature of handedness. In fact, Louis Pasteur said that when he discovered handedness in the polarity of certain crystals he was studying, he flipped and went into an ecstatic state of illumination. Pasteur believed that chirality contains the secret of life. And Jan Kerouac, at the age of 13, experienced chirality when she was in a psychedelic state. And she described it to me, how she would walk down a street in New York City, deserted in the middle of the night, and how she saw the world in front of her not moving relative to her steps. That is to say, you walk down the street and you pass the lamppost, you pass the doorway of a store, you pass a stoop of a house. No, it didn't actually move in that way at all. It stayed completely stable, and the space in front of her parted. It parted and divided and revealed the chirality of the universe. And Jan told me that she was a little bit afraid because she thought that if she took a certain step and she moved in a certain way, she could step right into the crack of the chirality, and she thought that she might disappear. This is coming from a 14-year-old girl. And such were our first conversations in those early months of 1967. Those of you who've read my books, especially Twins and the Double, will immediately see the relevance of this conversation that I had with Jan. You'll immediately recognize that the very topic she introduced to me, both topics in fact, came forward later on in my writing, and they came to be essential premises of teaching, especially as regards Gaian shamanism and ethnogenic shamanism. I wrote in Twins and the Double I stated what Jan had told me in that conversation many years before, namely that shamans in an ethnogenic trance using sacred plants can see the molecular structure of nature, and they can observe the permutations of DNA, as I have done so myself, consistently. I mean, you don't just see it, you can go looking for it, you know. And in additionally, the other point, which is closely related, you experience the magic and the maya of chirality. And you find that elaborated in my book, Twins in the Double, as a resonance of one of the first conversations I had with Jan Kerouac. Other minor point I'd like to mention is about the hill above my house. You might be intrigued by the term Ava Gardner Oaks. Why did I name the hill of Ava Gardner Oaks? Well, here in Andalusia, there are oak trees which are called dwarf oaks, but they're not small, really. Some of them are 20 feet tall or taller, but they are small, I suppose, compared to the classic oak that you would find, say, in an English forest or in the United States. The classic oak, as you know, is a massive, massive tree with a massive trunk and huge, huge limbs. So these Andalusian oaks are a special species of its own, and they are on a smaller scale, which is a great advantage for sorcerers and those of us who do courting, because it is possible to reach, to stand by one of these oaks and reach into the limbs and do courting in these trees. But one of the characteristics of the Andalusian oak is the flagrant erotic gestures of the limbs. The limbs and the trunk of the oak is black, is dark, and the leaves of the oaks are, of course, green, not a kind of a middle green going toward dark, which a green which glistens in the sunlight. And so you see, looking at these oaks, you see the overall greenness of the foliage, and then within that, you see these writhing motions of the limbs, which are reminiscent of the gestures of flamenco dancers. And when I was up there one time in an altered state, it occurred to me that the beauty, the arresting beauty of the gestures of these limbs is also reminiscent, just came to me in this way, of the profile of Ava Gardner, you know, that has that proudness, that proud look that you would see. Can you imagine Ava Gardner standing there with her body sort of twisted in a turn to the side and in a kind of a defiant stance with her chin held up slightly, and that fantastic profile of hers and that look in her eyes. And this is how the oaks look at you. They look at you with the gaze of Ava Gardner. So that's why they are so named. Finally, to make the transition into the topic of this briefing, number 49, I have something else to say about the crystalline drop on the mirror. You may have noticed a change of tone and intention in the last briefing, the one I did on Jan's birthday. There is a moment happening right now, a moment in correction, where the process of correction begins to engage the entire world. Now, I've been very reticent to talk about this or to suppose this or propose this so far. As you know, the Nahual is shy. The Nahual is cautious. I don't predict, and I don't want to make wild suppositions. It's not my desire, and it's not my style. Those of you who are in the Gaian navigation experiment, who are in GNE, and who are committed to planetary tantra, already know the degree of sobriety required for this practice, and it is exceptional. So if the moment comes for me to announce that correction begins to engage the entire human race, you can bet that I am going to look closely at my sobriety. And if I make such an announcement as I am now indeed doing, I intend to stay firmly in my warrior sobriety as I do so. I think it is helpful to use an image or a metaphor or whatever they call these things to understand how it could be that correction would reach the collective mind of the human race, of the human herd. How could that be? Or to put it in other terms, how could it be that the terma of Gaia awakening would actually reach the entire world? Let me tell you how that happens. Hold up your right hand flat and look down at your palm. And then mentally place a mirror on your hand, a rectangular mirror with the reflecting surface upward. So now you're looking down at this mirror, but you don't see yourself, let's say you're holding your hand out from your body. So you're not looking down at your own reflection, but you know that if you moved your hand, you could see your own reflection in the mirror. As it is, let's say you're standing outside, you're holding the mirror steady, it's perfectly horizontal, reflecting surface up, and all you see in the mirror is the blueness of the sky above. Now, bring that mirror up, raise it, bring it up to the level of your mouth, and blow on it. You blow on the mirror, and what happens? Your breath condenses as a mist on the mirror. So now put the mirror down in its place again, and you're looking down at it, and you have a mirror surface, but it's covered with mist, the condensation of breath. There's a fog on the mirror. The fog on the mirror of the mind of humanity is called thought, conceptualization. It's like a fog on the mirror. And as long as the mirror is covered with this condensation, this vapor of condensation, you can't really see things reflected in the mirror. Now imagine, hold the mirror steady in front of you. Keep the visualization that it is coated with a thin layer of mist. Your breath on the mirror is the same as your thought in the mirror of original mind. Now imagine a drop the size of a small pearl. It's perfectly crystalline. It's like a transparent resin or a transparent drop of gin or rain. And imagine it's descending slowly down toward the surface of the mirror. In this visualization, you can use a kind of slow motion technique. Visualize the drop, the descent of the drop, carefully, as if it's in slow motion. And then, likewise, in super slow motion, picture what happens when this crystalline distilled drop hits the surface of the mirror. Well, normally, in the natural world, when something like that happens, when a raindrop hits the still surface of a pond, or when a drop of water hits the surface of a mirror, the drop shatters. And you've seen that event. There are fantastic photographic clips showing in super, super, super slow motion what happens when a drop of rain hits the surface of a lake, and it is absolutely a miracle to behold. So just in terms of the natural world, the phenomenon to be pictured here is something of astounding beauty. But I'm asking you to consider this visualization to bring yourself to see a supernatural phenomenon. And so in the supernatural phenomenon, the drop of Dakini elixir does not behave like a drop of water when it hits a surface. Considered as a supernatural event, there are two different things that can happen when the drop of the Dakini elixir hits the mirror. The first thing is that the drop dissolves entirely and instantaneously into the entire mirror. It clears the mirror, it dissolves into the mirror, and in some miraculous manner, the Dakini essence, the distilled elixir, fuses into the mirror, so there is no longer a distinction between the mirror and that drop. And that is the state of cosmic consciousness that describes the state of cosmic consciousness that has been achieved through the ages by certain yogis and by certain mystically illuminated people, and some people in our time as well. Most notably, David Sperow, S-P-E-R-O, and you can go on YouTube and find many clips of David Sperow speaking. I would say that David Sperow is one of the very few, maybe the only one that I know of anyway, truly illuminated human animals in the world today who has experienced the genuine samadhi and who remains in samadhi. And if you were to understand the state of mind from which David Sperow speaks, then that is the state of mind in which the distilled drop of the Dakini elixir has fused with the mirror. And so that even if mist appears upon the mirror, it's not the same as the mist that would appear if the mirror were not fused with the Dakini drop. So David Sperow has thoughts, but they're not ordinary thoughts. They're not thoughts that arise in an ordinary condition. They're thoughts that arise from his samadhi, which is constant and perpetual. And David Sperow has some remarkable things to say, and I would point out to you that although I am of the school or path of Mayavada Vedanta, which is a dualistic path, David Sperow is of the path of Advaita Vedanta, which is a non-dual path, and yet in many respects, he speaks as a Mayavadin, and in some cases has even spoken directly of the supremacy of Shakti, and the supremacy of Shakti over Shiva, and this, of course, is a Mayavadin view. So, if the drop of crystal elixir does not spread and merge with the entire surface of the mirror, then what does happen? Well, this is the second possibility, the second form of enlightenment. Imagine that you're looking at the surface of the mirror held in the palm of your hand. It's coated with the mist of your breath, which is your thinking, the field of thought. In slow, slow, slow motion, the drop descends, and when it hits the surface of the mirror, it just settles there and remains intact as a drop. So just picture that moment. It does not shatter. It does not spread across the surface of the mirror, expanding in all directions. It just sits there on the surface as an intact drop. And when it touches the surface of the mirror, all of the mist on the surface of the mirror instantly dissolves. And so you have a perfectly clear mirror with a perfectly intact crystalline drop of elixir sitting on it. And this is the experience that I had when I received the terma of Gaia Awakening. The teaching of the terma, the transmission, to speak more correctly in the old idiom, the transmission of the terma derives from the position and condition of the drop. Get it? Keep that image in mind. I think it will be helpful. I know it will be extremely helpful to understand the point that we have now reached in the GNE, the point when the entirety of the human species itself can become involved in Sophia's correction. You wonder, as I do, how this could possibly happen, and how can we even think about it happening without going into make-believe and wild suppositions and groundless claims. In short, how can you retain your sobriety in the face of this momentous consideration? I propose that you maintain your sobriety by picturing your sobriety as the intact dewdrop on the mirror. That's the picture of the poise of your sobriety and mine. Now, I said in the previous talk that the term of Gaia Awakening reaches humanity in the same way that it reached one human animal. It reaches everyone in the same way. And so that drop is falling on the mirror of the mind of humanity at the same time that it is falling on the mirror of my mind and your mind. This is where your mind goes out of time into a fractalization of illuminated attention, a fractalization of illuminated attention. At a certain moment in the year 2008, that drop of Dakini elixir, which contains the terma of Gaia Awakening, hit the mirror of my mind. But at that same time, it also hit the mirror of the mind of everyone on this planet at that same time. So what then is time? Why didn't everyone get the terma of Gaia Awakening at the same moment that I did? That didn't happen because time, as a condition of such events, is completely illusory. The terma of Gaia Awakening awakes in the mind of every single human animal at the moment that they realize the dew is on the mirror. And so, if the terma of Gaia Awakening awakes in the mind of some individual February 22nd, 2013, someone living in Canada, someone living in Japan, someone living in New Zealand, that is an event held in the fractal structure of time simultaneous with the event of the dew dropping into my mind. And this imagery shows how Kali destroys the illusion of time by revealing the miracle of its fractalization. You see, Kali destroys all illusions including the illusion of time. But when she does so, you are not left with timelessness. You are left with moments structured in timelessness. The power of Kali comes into play through the dimension of time and comes into play through the illusion of linear time. Her power comes into play within time. She destroys time from within. She doesn't destroy it from without. And so, every single human animal who awakens to the Terma of Gaia awakening, who realizes and registers the Terma of Gaia awakening, who recognizes that it exists and what it is, what is it, what does it say? Every human animal who recognizes that experiences the drop of Dakini elixir, which I call, in some of the writings I did in October 2008, heart drop medicine. Everyone gets the heart drop medicine out of the sky of the Dakinis in the same way. That is such. Now, that might sound like a wild supposition, but I can go much deeper into this if you like. I can be much more precise about this, and I can be extremely concrete. Oh, yes, indeed. What I now invite you to understand along with me, because I teach what I'm learning, and I'm just learning this as I'm saying it to you, I'm learning it. Do you get that? What I invite you to realize now is that due to the conditioning of the human mind and the conditioning of the collective mind of the herd of the human animals, there are two ways in which the Terma of Gaia awakening and the involvement in Sophia's correction will break through into ordinary consciousness. Remember that she is performing, she must perform in order to achieve her intervention, an act of double orchestration. This is shamanic jargon, okay? Double orchestration. She orchestrates not only from the nahual into the tonal, but she operates and orchestrates from the tonal into the nahual. And for that second orchestration, she requires a measure of human participation. Go back and read about that and make sure you get it real, real clear how double orchestration works. Consequently, the human animals on this planet will automatically fall into two groups. There will be those who directly and imminently cognitively seize the power of the Terma of Gaia awakening, and those who receive it indirectly. So it's a direct and an indirect transmission. You can find a lot of blah, blah, blah about this kind of thing around the subject of Padmasambhava in the schools of Tantrayana and the schools of Tibetan Buddhism and so forth. A lot of, for instance, in Tuku Tondup's book, The Secret Teachings of Tibet, you find various traditional distinctions in the way that termas are transmitted. And you have the mind transmission termas and other technicalities. I have to tell you that all of that is instructive. You know, you can go read his book. I recommend that you read his book. All of that is instructive, but it's all in total, total meltdown. I had an audience with a Tibetan Lama in Santa Fe around 1985. I think it was Dudjom Rinpoche, D-U-D-J-O-M, In fact, I'm looking at a picture of him right now, and I see his face, which reminds me of a buffalo. And as I recall, it was a big hulk of a man with a rounded, kind of rounded shoulders and heavy torso. That reminded me of a buffalo, as well as his face and his attitude. It was sort of like sitting there beside a huge bison. So I do believe that's who it was, although I can't confirm it. Anyway, what happened on that fine September day in Santa Fe was that this Lama, this Rinpoche, gifted me with the entire download of all of the magical and metaphysical teachings of the Nyingma tradition. And what now comes forth in free, because I told him a joke. And what comes forth in this progression of time here, progression of linear time, what comes forth now is the total meltdown of that transmission into a new ore, a new kind of ore. And from this ore, from this sacred metallic essence of the distillation of the entire Nyingma wisdom, comes planetary tantra. And so I don't have to go back, and no one has to go back and pick up these things and practice them over years and study them, because everything that is contained, for instance, in the secret teachings of Tibet occurs in a new formulation in planetary tantra. It's as if there was a school and a movement that produced all of these magical ornaments: Dorjes, bells, swords, daggers, spears, mirrors, and all of this regalia, all this paraphernalia. And it's as if you took it all and threw it in a big melting pot and melted it all down back to a primary ore, and out of that primary ore constructed new instruments, new implements of magical power. This is what I do. This is what I can do. Not only because I received the term of Gaia Awakening and I practice what I received, but because I also have a backup from that meeting on that moment with that Tibetan master, whoever it was. So there you go. There's a pretentious and arrogant claim that ought to set some heads spinning, right? I really wonder if it would set some hearts spinning. That's what I'd like to see. I'd like to see it set some hearts spinning so that the needle of the heart and of the heart compass would spin wildly, and then when it stopped, it would point in a new direction. Anyway, excuse me for that slight digression. I've not ever spoken publicly before of the mind mandate transmission that I received in that manner. As far as I know, I haven't. To return to the direct and indirect types of transmission, there is a direct mind mandate transmission that brings everyone who receives it into an active role in Sophia's correction, and of course, an active role in planetary tantra. This direct mind transmission happens when you experience the heart drop medicine. And some of you already have. There are, however, a great many human animals who are too insensitive mentally, emotionally, physically, psychosomatically to know that they are receiving the heart drop medicine. And so those people, those individuals who represent, of course, the vast majority of the human race, would then be directed into correction by the group of other people who have the direct experience. So those who have the direct experience direct those who have the indirect experience. This is the formula. And it is a two-pronged transmission. It is a two-pronged, massive, momentous act of mind mandate transmission, to use the classical Nyingma term. And the image of the bull with its two horns and the thrusting power of the bull that you see when you visualize that constellation, that you feel when you observe that magnificent constellation, that dual-pronged thrusting power is now operating. The dual transmission is on. And it is possible, it becomes possible now, for those of us in the GNE and Planetary Tantra to transmit to others what is being transmitted through us. And the instrument for doing that is, you guessed it, Channel 16. So, in my final reference for the moment to this exercise of imagination, look closely at the upturned mirror held steadily, perfectly horizontal, in the palm of your hand. And picture what happens when that perfect drop, which is teardrop shape, like a bindu, touches the surface of the mirror. Look, what do you see? Well, you see the reflection of the drop in the mirror, and the reflection is joined to the drop at the point where the drop touches the mirror. And so you see something like an hourglass shape, the teardrop shape above and the reflected teardrop below. The teardrop above, the distilled essence of heart drop medicine, represents a direct transmission. The reflection of that teardrop below in the mirror represents the indirect transmission, and they are simultaneous. And so, with this image in mind, let's turn to the fascinating subject of patriarchy, the gruesome, gruesome subject of patriarchy, and see how this all relates to the current moment with the upcoming apogee surge in 16 degrees of Gemini, that is, between the horns of the bull, and with Jupiter now advancing from its retrograded position, advancing toward perfect alignment between the star Aldebaran and the star Alnat. Well, I would suppose that most of you listening to this briefing around the time that it's being made would have heard of recent events. Namely, that the Pope has resigned, Pope Benedict XVI, I think that's his title, Joseph Ratzinger, has resigned, and this is the first resignation of a pope in 600 years. And also, closely timed to the announcement of the Pope's resignation, a lightning bolt hit the dome of the Vatican. Have you seen that picture? If that's not a faked picture, well, then it really did happen. VV struck the very heart of patriarchy in the Roman Catholic Church. He struck the dome of the Vatican within a few days of the resignation of the Pope. And I might add, to factor myself into the equation, that the Italian edition of not in his image comes out at exactly the same time that the Pope announces his resignation. It comes out, in fact, between the moment of the announcement of the resignation and the resignation itself. That is when this book appears in Italian. Figure that. Now, you may recall, those of you who are on board the GNA, that I have made a statement at the beginning of this experiment. I raised the question, well, what can we expect? Are we going to see the whole world change? Are we going to see a collective awakening of humanity? Suddenly, people are running around in the streets screaming VV. And are we going to see the term of Gaia awakening discussed all around the world? Are we going to see these things? No, I didn't predict any of those things, did I? I made a sober and carefully measured proposition, which is that in the 3 years from March 2011 to March 2014, the Aeon Sophia herself would collapse all of the constricting and suffocating patriarchal structures and paradigms on this planet. I did say that, didn't I? I said, we can't do it because the job is too big for any single human animal and even for a massive group or movement of humans. It's too big. The error is too far out of scale to be corrected by human intention. And so I said, leave it to Pam. Leave it to the planetary animal mother. Using her own powers, her own mental powers, she is fully capable of totally collapsing the patriarchal and theocratic paradigms that are running humanity to ruin and ruining her experiment. Running humanity into self-destruction, into insanity and depravity, and ruining her experiment and turning the theater of her experiment into a vaudeville scene of disgusting ugliness. Okay? She can do it. She is doing it. And this is the first concrete proof on a massive scale. And I would venture to guess that it is only the first. In a way, it's the easiest shot, because the Catholic Church is obviously the most flagrantly disgusting and deceptive and depraved expression of patriarchy and theocracy on the planet. There is a more disgusting expression, as you well know. And you know exactly of what I speak, don't you? But that is hidden. And there's another way for that to be handled. But speaking of the downfall of the Catholic Church, well, that is something to celebrate, isn't it? And you can keep your eyes peeled for what goes next. Just make a list and put it on your fridge. And then check the news every morning for the next 14 months. What's going next? You know, let's say, what's on my list? The British royal family. Now, there's an ugly bunch of vermin. I would love to see them go down in a really ugly, nasty way. And there's, science, the fraud of string theory, of quantum mechanics, of Einsteinian relativity, all the scientific fraud that's been perpetrated on this planet for the last 150 years, deliberately perpetrated, is part of the patriarchal system of male mind dominance that goes down. The banking system goes down. The corporations, Monsanto. Would you love to see Monsanto go down? Love to see the CEO, the board of directors, everyone who runs Monsanto, watch them go down. Can she do that? You bet your life she can do that. You can't do that, and I can't do that, apart from, you know, isolated acts of elucidated violence, which would be extremely difficult to pull off and extremely dangerous to achieve without sacrificing yourself in a kamikaze manner. And I want to emphasize that there is nothing of the sort to be done in planetary tantra and Kalika war strategies. Kamikaze acts are completely excluded from this practice. Although the use of lethal, elucidated violence is not excluded, as you know. So the war party is forming. The three bands of Kalika warriors, one directly behind Kali, that's the male band, on the right flank, the woman warriors behind Matangi, and on the left flank, the motley crew of men and women warriors behind Kurukula. And this party, the visualization of this party is like, makes my day. I stand in that party, in the ranks, and you know exactly where I am, don't you? And you can put yourself right there with me and with the Nawal's woman. And what a thrill it is to hold that visualization and to know that this is absolutely real. This is real. Castaneda's war party, Castaneda's Neo-Toltec sorcery group was just a warm-up exercise for what this is. So, those of us in the ranks of the Kalika War Party have much to celebrate this month of February 2013. It appears to be in this month and in the second Matangi shift that correction is really kicking in to the collective theater of events in the human world. It really appears to be so. And I would like to point out something else to you that's brought to my attention by Elena, one of the women in the war party, who is also my most diligent and impeccable Italian translator. Elena sent me a link to some blog dealing with the third prophecy of Fatima. And I'd like to point out that according to the people writing about this event, the third prophecy of Fatima, which was never disclosed and was held as some kind of deep secret by the Catholic Church, that it is now said that the third prophecy describes the final and complete end of the Catholic Church and of the theocratic, fraudulent theocratic system of Catholicism. It's not just even a theocratic system, it's a fraudulent theocratic system. Indicating a date. Get this, a date. May 13th, 2013. Okay? Well, I thought something about that date when I read it in the link that Elena sent me. I said, that date, May 13th, 2013, that seems to refer to something. So I pulled out this this very, very ragged sheaf of six pages that I have stapled together in the corner. And this is the original list of the perigee and apogee surges during correction. It's six pages long, and I always refer to it. Here it is. It goes down to April, May of 2014. And here you go. On the left column, the perigee surges. On the right, the apogee surges. And I leaf through it like I'm doing right now. 2012, well, that was a hell of a year. Okay, 2013. Let's see. Oh, apogee surges, 2013. Well, it starts out January 22nd in the Eye of the Bull. February 19th, coming up in a couple of days, advancing to between the horns of the bull. March 19th, apogee surge, 23 Gemini, which is further out in the horns of the bull. April 15th, 28 Gemini, which, by the way, is conjunct the Crab Nebula, right at the opening between the two horns of the bull, between the two horn tips. And wait, what's this? May 13th, 2013. The apogee of the moon reaches 1 degree of Cancer. That is 91 degrees on the ecliptic scale. Where does that place it in the constellations? Beyond the horn tips of the bull, in the twinkly little feet of the twins. So, what you see in May of 2013 is a constellational shift of the lunar apogee. Well, we pay attention to these things, don't we? I have said that there are three great lessons to be learned in correction. One is the lesson that unfolded when the lunar apogee passed before the satanic head of Cetus. The second is the lesson currently unfolding, lunar apogee in transit through the bull. And the third and final lesson is the lunar apogee in transit through the twins. And that lesson begins with a bang on May 13th, 2013, which apparently is the date indicated in the third forbidden and hidden prophecy of Fatima. Well, imagine that. Score one for the navigator, if I do say so myself. Now, in regard to this remarkable development, the first actual event on a global scale that reflects the unfoldment of correction and corresponds point by point to the navigational indicators. Let me relate a little anecdote that happened recently here in my part of the world. I was sitting at Ambergane House with Kundry, and we were looking at the course of the lunar apogee in the constellations. We're discussing this fascinating question of the three great lessons connected with the ram facing the head of Cetus, the bull, and the twins. And I had some of my navigational notes out. We were looking at it on a table with some star maps and other things relating to Starbase and Quest for the Zodiac, which are currently getting pulled together down there. And I said, you know, hey, look at this, you know. See this here? There's the horns of the bull. This is where the lunar apogee is now, which is coming out of the stall, as everyone knows. And as it pulls out of the stall, it gains quite rapidly. For instance, in the month since the last apogee surge, which was on, got it right here, on the 22nd of January, in that month, until the 19th of February, the lunar apogee has advanced 6 degrees. So it's like lunging out of its stall. It's just lunging 6 degrees in 1 month. And I traced with my finger the course it's going to take against the background of the constellations. As I just noted, it advances between the horns of the bull. Get the bull by the horns. This is the moment to get the bull by the horns, or maybe it's the moment to leap between the horns of the bull in the manner of those wonderful acrobats you see in Minoan frescoes. So I said, look, here's what happens. In February and March, it actually moves into the area of the Milky Way, which lies, spreads between the bull and the twins. And then, lo and behold, here in the month of May, it passes over into the twins, and that is the first time that the apogee reaches the twins. And interestingly, I noted, talking to Kundry, that the point that it enters the constellation of the twins is actually a very significant point in terms of the structural dynamics of the entire solar system. And why is that? Quite simply because the position of the apogee surge on May 13th, 1 degree of Cancer, corresponds to the location of the perihelion of Saturn. So this is an astronomical fact. I'm not making this up. This is something that the navigator knows, something the navigator must know in order to be the navigator. Now, I've had my eye on this point, the perihelion of Saturn, since about August 1974. Yes, that would be correct. In April of 1974, I went from Santa Fe to Los Angeles with the specific purpose of investigating the works of Rudolf Steiner. And so I knew there was a large Steiner Center in LA, and I went there. And in August of that year, a man came to the Rudolf Steiner Research Library and gave an astrological workshop, or actually an astrosophical workshop. That man was Willy Suker, who was a student of anthroposophy. And he founded a school of astrology based on Steiner's work, which he called astrosophy, containing the word Sophia, astro-Sophia. So I attended this workshop with Willy Suker, and I had a couple of private meetings with him. I was extremely interested in some points of method that he used, particularly because he incorporated actual astronomy into his calculations, which very few astrologers do, as you know. They don't know anything about astronomy. Now, it's a fact, and everyone in the crew has to know this, that the orbits of the planets in the solar system, take for instance the three outer planets, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, are not circular. They are elliptical or egg-shaped. And therefore, they do not have a single center, but they have two centers. An ellipse has two foci. A circle has one foci, one focus. And so, just as you know that the moon at a certain moment is closest, at its closest point to the Earth, its perigee, meaning close to the Earth, and at another moment, at its most distant point from the Earth, its apogee, likewise for the planets, but they are not called by those terms which refer to G or Gaia or the Earth. They are called by terms which refer to the Sun. So perihelion is the point closest to the Sun, aphelion, the point most distant to the Sun. So the orbit of Saturn has a perihelion and an aphelion, which are opposite to each other. And the perihelion of Saturn is located right now, currently, in about 1 or 2 degrees of the sign Cancer, which places it at the border of the constellation of the Twins, in the feet of the Twins. Now, when I studied with Willy Suker, he indicated something to me that I found at the time rather amazing, and I do continue to find it amazing. Let's see what you think. Willy Suker said that he studied closely the movements of planets that occurred in the 9 months of someone's gestation. So he would work back from the birth date of someone to an approximate date, 9 months or so in the past, and he would observe carefully, in the heliocentric perspective, I have to say, he did this heliocentrically, that is, on a format with the Sun at the center, he observed how the planets moved during that 9 month period. And what Willy Suker told me was that there are moments when the planets, a planet such as Jupiter or a planet such as Saturn, will touch these perihelia and aphelia points during this 9 month period. Give you an example. Suppose that you were born during a 9 month period and the planet Jupiter during that time moved through the sky, and it moved through the perihelion of Saturn. So what you have then is an actual movement of the planet Jupiter, an actual transit in the sky during the time that you are in the womb, up to the moment you're born, and looking at the sky map heliocentrically, you see that it touches one of these points of structural orientation in the solar system. And that may all sound extremely arcane, but what came next was really the icing on the cake. When Willy Suka said to me, each of these perihelia and aphelia of the planets, such as Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, can be shown to represent massive impulses in human evolution. And he named them according to certain historical impulses or historical movements. And he said that it's as if these perihelia and aphelia alignments in the sky, which can be tracked over time, over centuries, carry the memory, as it were, this is his language, they carry the memory of certain impulses of a transpersonal and transhistorical nature. And that if you have a planet that touches one of those points during the time of your gestation, then you incorporate that impulse into your very being. And this is the manner in which individual human animals appear on this earth carrying, as it were, the ongoing impulses that determine the development of the entire human species. This is the picture I got from Willy Suka. And I continued in my own astrological work subsequently to extensively research this to see if it could be proven by biographical examples and to extensively apply it in my own case to myself and to apply it to my astrological clients at the time. So, of course, if you get what I'm saying, you'll get that also that the key to this interpretation, the key to this elaborate method of reading human destiny against the background of vast historical movements and developments through history, depends, of course, on being able to characterize what is the impulse or motif of each of those points. So, for instance, what is the impulse or motif represented by the perihelion of Jupiter? Or the perihelion or aphelion of Mars, or the perihelion or aphelion of Saturn. So you have a number of sets of data, which is purely astronomical data. Those are discrete sets of data that can be written down on a piece of paper. But then you have to add to that astronomical data the historical and existential characterization, the theme that is represented by these astronomical points. And so Willy Suka and I had deep conversations about this, and I remember he and I sitting at a desk. I had brought along a six-pack of German beer. We were sitting there drinking some beer, poring over these charts, and he points to this one chart, which was mine, that he had prepared for me. I still have this chart. And he said, look at this. He said, when you were born, Saturn... when you were conceived, 9 months before you were born, Saturn stood in its own perihelion at the feet of the twins. Aha! Okay. And I said, wow, yeah, I see that. This is at the very beginning before I even knew how to apply his method, which I later advanced considerably. I didn't know how it worked. He was showing me how it worked by using the example of my own chart. And he said, that's quite significant that Saturn would be in its own, stand in its own perihelion. That's a powerful indication. And so I took a sip of my German beer, I paused, and I said, sure, an indication of what? And he said, well, you have to consider the nature of the perihelion of Saturn. What does it represent in terms of history, in terms of the long-term evolution of the human race? And you have to consider how to characterize it, because each of these points of astronomy can be characterized by circumstances and movements and historical events, and he had actually done this. You do the background research. That's another story, how that research must be conducted. But when you do the background research, you can actually characterize this. And Vilisukha told me that according to his researches, he would say, on his best judgment, that the perihelion of Saturn represented what he called the Gnostic movement, Gnosticism, the power of Gnosis. He actually said this to me, sitting there, sipping on a German beer. And so I said, yeah, well, that's clear. That's clear. This was in August of 1974, and if you thought it was clear then, just think about how clear it is now. And so, as I was chatting with Kundry, I pointed to this. I mentioned the Sukha story that I just related. I told her the story. And I said, yeah, Vilisukha taught me to go and investigate these perihelia and aphelia of the planets in regard to their historical and spiritual significance, if you will. He taught me to regard them as depositories that carry enormous power of experience. The distilled power of experience is held at these points in some mysterious manner. And when a planet transits that point during the time that you are in your mother's womb, it signifies that the incarnating energy of the person to be born incorporates that world-shaping impulse. And so I said, this is how it is for me, but look what it is now. Look what it becomes now. I can say that I fulfilled that indication that Vilisukha initially pointed out to me, because obviously I am the only person on this planet who faithfully treated Gnosticism according to the Gnostics themselves, according to the Telestai, and who faithfully reconstructed and restored the sacred guiding narrative of the Gnostic mystery schools. And now what happens? What happens as the lunar apogee reaches and attains the perihelion of Saturn during the 3 years of correction? Well, what now happens is that this world-shaping, trans-historical impulse that came to be embodied in the life of one person can be released to the entire world. And the releasement comes at a moment when patriarchy ends, and when all of the structures of patriarchy and theocracy, which were constructed in the absence of Gnostic vision and based on the destruction of that vision, are themselves being destroyed. And it is really possible, in the timing of these events, for a massive resurgence out of the collective unconsciousness of humanity of the power of the Gnostic vision. But that process needs to be directed by that group of people who themselves are in direct line of transmission from Sophia, from the revelation of her instructions. It needs to be directed, just like violence needs to be directed. So both the violence inherent to our species and the wisdom inherent to our species are in some intimate way, closely, dynamically, and perhaps even magically related. So I leave you with that thought and with the wonderful revelation of this date, May 13th, 2013, coming up in the collective world, completely independent of our little experiment in the GNE. But nevertheless, there you have it. And if it's proof that you like, it's proof that you got. And we sail on from there. So steady as she goes, I'll be with you again soon.